I was 11 years old when I first set my eyes on the Grand Canyon. I'd heard a lot about it, I'd seen many pictures of it, but I was not prepared for its magnitude, beauty, mystery, the sheer grandeur of it. You have to see it to know it. And even better, you have to walk down into it. Nearly 5 million people visit the Grand Canyon each year, and only a tiny fraction of those actually get beneath the rim into the canyon. I was lucky on that first visit to go way far down in the canyon on a mule with my family. Actually, it was pretty terrifying. Now, about one person a year in the Grand Canyon falls to their death, and the mule's track record is way better than that, but it didn't feel like it. So often it would kind of stumble and just correct itself, and then on the hairpin turns, it would go all the way to the edge, stop, and then turn. And then I happen to have this ornery mule that didn't like to keep up with the one ahead of it, and then periodically would run to catch up. So in terror, down we traveled, down through the ages. If we had gone all the way to the floor of the canyon, we would have been among rocks that are 1.7 billion years old. These rocks come from this tall mountain range that once was there, a mountain range much taller than the Rocky Mountains today. Over time, this ancient range eroded to almost nothing. Sediments left by advancing and retreating oceans mostly covered the area, and you can see the distinctive layers of sedimentation on the canyon walls. These sedimentary rocks were then subject to the same thing as the mountain range, erosion caused by rainwater, ice, wind. The top layer of rocks is 250 million years old. Newer rock has long ago been worn away. Some 60 to 70 million years ago, the ancestor of today's Colorado River altered the picture, and it became another powerful force for erosion. About 17 million years ago, the Colorado Plateau began to uplift. The river continued to cut as the rocks lifted for about 5 million years. Since then, primarily river, rain, and ice have shaped the canyon the way it looks today. Well, as an 11-year-old, I didn't quite understand all this geology. But what I did know is that what I was seeing was the result of hundreds of millions of years of remarkable development. And I knew that it was impossible to be in that canyon and not feel small. Small physically, but also small in the magnificent scope of our planet's unfolding. And I did not return to the Grand Canyon for 35 years, long enough to forget just how amazing it is when you see it in person. I felt that same awe when I stepped up to the South Rim on that visit 35 years later. The centerpiece of this next trip was a four-day hike from the South Rim up to the North Rim. This time I got to go all the way down to the bottom and then up the other side. And even though we divided this hike, this 24 miles, into 4 days, it was still not easy. First of all, it was June and really, really hot, like 110 degrees in the shade. We had these big packs, and the hardest day of all was the last day, 7 miles, 4,200 feet of elevation gain in the hot sun. The pack's still really full, even though I felt like I'd eaten a lot of the food. But I made it. And it was really incredible to be on the North Rim and look back and think, I crossed that. Walking through the Grand Canyon over those 4 days, I was so struck by having this sort of intimate experience with the canyon, not the big overview from on top, but really intimate. And I especially loved to see the changing play of light as each day unfolded on the canyon walls. So it was at breakfast at the lodge that next day after making it to the North Rim that the seed was planted for another trip to the Grand Canyon. So we were all feeling pretty good about this accomplishment, and bragging about it was not beneath us, so we were bragging. And our weight person knowingly nodded and said, "Oh yeah, I did that last Thursday." So we deflated a bit as we heard about her doing the rim to rim in one day. Here it felt like 4 days about killed us. And though she was 25 years younger than me and certainly in much better shape, the gauntlet had been laid. "Wouldn't it be neat to do that," I said to a hiking buddy. "Wouldn't it be neat to cross this in one day? No big pack to carry. Oh, it'd be awesome." So he agreed, and we figured, you know, the time to do this wouldn't be June, it'd be October. So after it got cool, before the snow hit the North Rim. Well, sometime last spring, I forgot about the wisdom of doing the rim to rim in one day in October. You see, I was headed to Phoenix for the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly in late June. Well, I'm going to be in Arizona anyway. Just tack on a couple extra days, go up there and do that. So I said this to the hiking buddy from that last trip, and he said, "Sure, let's go for it." So as it happened, I happened to visit the Grand Canyon just 2-3 weeks before that big hike. So early June, I went on a long train trip with my dad across the country. And my dad feels the same connection to the Grand Canyon that I do. So we got off the train in Flagstaff and rented a car and went up to the Grand Canyon. So knowing that this big hike was just a few weeks off and I wasn't really doing a lot of training on the train, I got up one morning at 3:30 in the morning, headed out to the Bright Angel Trail on the South Rim, and headed down. I decided I'd go down 2.5 hours and then turn around. Everything went beautifully. It actually took me only 40 minutes longer to go up, even though it was 3,000 feet of elevation gain. In total, I did the 10 miles in 5.5 hours, and I pronounced myself good to go. So at the end of General Assembly a few weeks later, I traveled to the airport in Phoenix and picked up my hiking buddy, and we drove up to the canyon. So for this sermon, I'm going to call my hiking buddy Tom. Like Tom Hanna. Tom Hanna from the fellowship who will be here at the next service, probably sitting in there. Just call him that. So Tom and I knew that it was essential to cover as much ground as we possibly could when it was dark and in the early morning before the sun came directly into the canyon. So we got up at 1 a.m., hit the trailhead by 2 a.m. The task ahead was simple. Hike 24 miles, 4,500 feet down, 6,000 feet up. Down we headed. Our headlamps clicked on. I was in the lead. So when I'd been there a few weeks before, I had set a blistering pace for that downward hike, and I decided to match it. You know, the more ground we cover, the better. We'll be out of that scorching sun. Plus, it's downhill. How hard then can that be? So off we raced. Two highlights of the first part of that hike. One was hiking along and seeing a scorpion on the trail with our little lights. And the other was then seeing a rattlesnake a few minutes later. The low lights were the bats that flew in the light. I'm really scared of bats and screamed every time. But two small problems besides the bats nagged at me as we were going down. First, from the moment I woke up, my stomach was off. I just didn't feel like eating. Cliff bars, trail mix, sounded awful. So I didn't eat much. Along the way, I saw a sign that explained that when your body's hot, it takes a lot of energy to deal with the heat. So you need to fuel your body by eating. So it kind of sowed a little seed of doubt. Also, I noticed on the downward slope that I was sweating a lot. And I hadn't done that a few weeks before. Must be a little hotter, I thought. Well, after getting water and resting for a tiny bit at the bottom of the canyon at Phantom Ranch, Tom took over the lead. Inspired by my pace, he took off at a good clip. You know, let's get there, and it really wasn't that much of an elevation rise at this point. So I fairly quickly realized, I can't really keep up with him. I elected not to mention this to Tom, and instead just periodically sort of ran to try to catch up. The walk up the Bright Angel Creek, which is this part of the trail, was spectacular, highlighted by this heron that flew along the creek. And it would fly a little bit ahead of us, land, and when we got near, it'd fly on a little more, 4 miles. I thought of the swan in Mary Oliver's poem. During this stretch, the sun rose high enough to shine directly down on us, and so we were bathed in sunlight pretty much the rest of the hike. At 17 miles into the hike, we took our first extended break at the Cottonwood Campground. Now, because this campground adjoins the Bright Angel Creek, there's a lot of groundwater and there are trees, so there was happily shade. Here I need to give a little bit of a warning, that a disclaimer of sorts, that there's going to be some graphic details to the rest of the story, starting with a bad episode of diarrhea at this particular point. Again, I elected not to tell Tom what was going on with me. I do think I volunteered that I was struggling a bit, and the rest really was great. Onward we headed. 7 miles, 4,200 vertical feet yet to go. I didn't feel great, but there's lots of daylight. We're ahead of schedule. We could take our time. So we did take breaks more frequently. Tom began to realize I wasn't keeping up and slowed up. Increasingly worried about dehydration, I started pounding the water in the Gatorade. But unfortunately, the pace of my physical descent quickened as we pressed onward in the hill and the trail got steeper. Finally, after struggling for maybe 4 more miles, my body just said, "We're done." And I threw myself down on the side of the trail and could not move. It happened that the spot I found had this little bush that I could just get my head under to get a little bit of shade, but the rest of my body was in the sunlight. We were close to running out of water, so Tom decided to carry my pack and go up a mile or so to the next water spot, a place called Supai Tunnel, where there was a little tunnel through the rock. He was going to refill the water, leave the packs, come back, and fetch me. Shortly before his return, I threw up all the water, all the Gatorade, everything in my tummy, the volume of which I have never seen anything like before. This is not good. Evidently, Tom was worried about leaving me alone because ran back. I don't think my appearance made him feel reassured. I could sense growing alarm in his face. Fortunately, though, I felt a little bit better, got up, and shuffled along onto Supai Tunnel. But maybe 50 yards short of Supai Tunnel, my body said, "Nope, that's it, we're done." And I collapsed to the ground again. Tom tried to coax me forward. "See, you can see. That's where we need to get right now. You can see it. You can do it." I couldn't. I couldn't even crawl there, I think, if I wanted to. Once again, I threw up buckets of stuff. Tom had to be exhausted from all this and from caring for me. The guy had just walked 22 miles, ran a mile in rugged country, and I can only imagine that he thought, "You know, I'm just going to say goodbye and walk up the rest of the way." But he was concerned about his friend and determined to get me safely to the top one way or another. So he kind of sprung into action. He recruited some help up at the tunnel ahead a little bit, came back with all these helpers in tow, Tom on one side, another guy on another side. I sort of was carried, half walked to the tunnel. All the people at the tunnel seemed to know what was going on with me, and they were rallying around. And then another amazing thing about all this with Tom is that he kept pulling useful things out of his day pack. Like, his pack seemed about as full as mine, but somehow he had all this stuff, and I couldn't help but think of Hermione and Harry Potter with their purse, with tents and furniture and all this stuff. So, just as magical, Tom pulls out this silver ground cover for me to lie on, even though at this point I didn't really care if I was lying on dirt and mule crap and vomit. While I rested, Tom was busy. It had occurred to him, given the situation, that it was getting kind of late in the afternoon, that we just might be spending the night in the canyon. So he went around and gathered all this clothing from people that we could use. It's going to get into the lower 40s at night. He also asked hikers going on to notify the rangers up at the top that there was a problem. And then two of the people he recruited, a couple named Dana and Myra, volunteered to stick with us. And Tom can't talk about them without tears coming to his eyes because he had felt so alone dealing with me. And finally, he had some help, some people that were going to be there with him each step of the way. I dozed on and off for who knows how long on that silver ground cover. And at some point, I remember Dana telling me, you know, if you get hauled out of here by the rangers, they charge you $1,500. Well, I thought then I have two options, spend the night or try to walk out. After another bout of diarrhea, I did find the strength to move on. Dana carried the pack. Tom must have been carrying all the extra clothes. 2 miles, nearly 1,500 vertical feet to go. A little way down the trail, I threw up again. And then around that point, two rangers did magically appear. They had heard from the hikers going on that someone was in trouble, and they figured out who it was. They asked me some questions, clearly trying to see how well my mind was functioning. And then they concluded that I had heat exhaustion. Honestly, it had never occurred to me that I had heat exhaustion. I thought I was just dehydrated, but that was because I had heat exhaustion. What a pity I didn't know this earlier, because all day long we were along really cool water that I could have plopped my body into and probably felt a whole lot better. But at this point, between where I was, those last 2 miles, no water. No way to do that. I now realize how lucky I was that my heat exhaustion didn't cross that threshold into heat stroke. When you have heat exhaustion, your body is still trying to cool itself. With heat stroke, it throws in the towel, your temperature goes high, and sometimes your brain gets fried. I'll never know how close I came to heat stroke. After the latest round of puking, I again felt good enough to push on, so accompanied by Tom, Dana and Myra, the two rangers, we went on our way hardly without stopping. It was time to finish this hike. And at long last, we made it to the North Rim. From there, we had another mile to go to get to the lodge, but thankfully the rangers put me in their car. With profuse thanks and a few tears from Tom and all the thanks I could muster, which wasn't very much, we did thank Dana and Myra, and they went on their way. Tom doled back all the clothing he had borrowed from hikers. They were waiting for him. So Dana and Myra, two strangers who almost certainly we'll never see again, made such a gift to us that we will never forget. During the car ride, I asked the ranger, do you really charge $1,500 to haul people out? Nah, he said, we don't charge anything. Oh, no, you tell me. So they drove us up to the lodge, dropped us off. Tom went in to register. I waited outside, and I had to lie down. You know, just had to lie down. I didn't want to lie on the ground. There was this low brick wall, kind of flat on top. So I lay on that, and I shook uncontrollably. And I noted that some people seemed to be alarmed by this sight. So shortly after the brief golf cart ride to the cabin, the emergency medical technicians came in, one of whom was one of the rangers. They checked me over. They connected a bunch of stuff to me. After consulting a doctor in Fargo, by phone, the EMT said, you know, I think you're going to be fine. You could go to the hospital if you want. I think you'll live if you don't. So I elected not to go to the hospital. Threw up again. Somehow someone magically appeared from the lodge to clean it up. And then I thought, you know, I better call my wife. So I called Amy. The signal was really bad, so I think she just heard a bunch of static with, you know, EMTs and heat exhaustion mixed in. But it didn't work really. So then I tried texting her, and between my shaking and my brain that wasn't working, it took every fiber of energy even to text one word. Finally, I asked Tom to go to an area of better reception, call her. Then I asked Tom to go get me a Coke. Then I said, I'm a little bit hungry. Go get me some food. Can you shut the lights off, Tom? And I think I asked him a couple other rude things that I don't quite remember. He did it all without complaint. I slept fitfully, but okay. The next day I woke up, not sore at all, which is kind of amazing, but really nauseous and really spent. We had a 5-hour shuttle ride that was not very pleasant. And our adventure was over. So the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon reveals truths about ourselves and about the world. So here are some of the things I've learned from my trips to the Grand Canyon, especially this last one. I've learned that I'm more susceptible to hubris and to the need to be macho than I would have guessed. It was hubris to let this 20-something-year-old lay down the gauntlet for me to think I had to go across that rim to rim in a day. It was hubris to take my tune-up hike, which was only 14 miles, 10 miles shorter than the real thing, as I'm good to go. It was hubris to set too fast of a pace for myself. It was hubris to ignore all the warnings about heat exhaustion that accompany the trail. And it was really an ill-fated attempt to be macho, to not mention my problems to Tom, and not to slow down. I've learned that it pays to be a little wiser about the adventures I take on. I don't want to live my life extremely cautiously, but I need to be judicious in the adventures I take on. Some adventures are just not worth the risk. Many times, sitting along that trail, struggling to move forward, I thought that this would be a really dumb way to die. I've learned from the canyon that people are amazing, starting with Tom Hanna and all those strangers who helped. What he did was amazing, all this intricate planning to make this thing work after things went sour for me. And how amazing that these total strangers agreed to be enlisted in his efforts. For me, that truly was just about the most powerful experience of the interdependent web and compassion that I've ever had. I've learned that with a lot of help from friends and strangers, sometimes you can persevere through some really tough things. Most of the time during those last 7 miles, I thought that I would not be able to get out of the canyon that day, if ever, on my own steam. And I was able to, of course, only with the help of a bunch of people. Most of all, I've learned from the Grand Canyon that this planet is really a wondrous place, a place of beauty and awe, billions of years in the making. I'll always remember as we got near the North Rim, and I'm struggling still, of course, I looked back and through the woods I could see the canyon all the way across to the other side. Even in my addled state, this took my breath away. This is the reality of life on this planet. It is an amazing, extraordinarily beautiful, incredible place. It should take our breath away. And not just in the Grand Canyon, but in our own backyards too. How we respond to this reality of life on this planet, to me, may be the greatest spiritual question of all. A person who is awake, awake in that Buddhist sense, sees, cherishes, and strives to protect this beauty. And have you two finally figured out what beauty is for? Mary Oliver writes. And have you changed your life? These are really good questions to ponder.